Welcome to the People and Projects Podcast, where you'll find interviews and insights to help you deliver projects and lead teams. You can find us on the web at peopleandprojectspodcast.com. Hi, this is Andy Kaufman, President of the Institute for Leadership Excellence and Development Corporate. Thank you for joining us for this edition of the People and Projects Podcast. You know, when was the last time you wanted to make a change at work? You know, maybe it's an approach on a project or something bigger, like maybe wanting to introduce a new way of doing projects, maybe using principles from agile project management. You know, chances are you face some resistance to your proposed changes. Yet one of our key responsibilities is to lead change, even when our ideas are getting shot down. Well, to give us insight on this topic, you could argue one of the best people in the world to talk to is Professor John Cotter. John's most recent book is entitled Buy-In, Saving Your Good Idea from Getting Shot Down, and is a great follow-on to his classic books on change. I had the opportunity to spend some extended time talking with John earlier this year and look forward to sharing that discussion with you over the course of two episodes. For our premium subscribers, your extra coaching podcast episode will come out with the second cast. In this first cast, John and I focus on the topic of change. Let's get to that interview now.
John P. Cotter is internationally regarded as the foremost speaker on the topics of leadership and change. His is the premier voice on how the best organizations actually achieve successful transformations. Dr. Cotter is the co-founder of Cotter International, a leadership organization that helps global 5,000 company leaders develop the practical skills and implementation methodologies required to lead change in a complex, large-scale business environment. Dr. Cotter has authored 18 books, 12 of them bestsellers, including Leading Change, The Heart of Change, and his latest book entitled Buy-In, Saving Your Good Idea from Getting Shot Down. John, welcome to the People and Projects Podcast.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, your work on change has been enormously helpful to me, certainly countless others. And in Leading Change, you present really the classic eight-step model to help provide a framework for leading large-scale changes. And as you talk about in The Heart of Change, sometimes we better understand a concept when we see it. So how about this? You know, in recent weeks, you've been seeing what's been going on over there in the Middle East. Let's take Egypt, for example. With time, we're going to know more about how this all shakes out. But in what ways might we see the eight stages in what's happened thus far? And in what ways is this maybe a different sort of change?
Now, I'm now increasingly convinced that when you're talking about groups of people, it doesn't matter if they're, you know, you're a project manager with 10 guys or if we're talking about a nation. The fundamentals of what makes successful changes happen or why they go awry or whether it can turn out to be a disaster or the same, must have something to do with human nature and just the nature of human groups. And so in situations like this, always the big question at the beginning is, is there a sense of real urgency, that people share?
Yeah.
That people share, particularly around not just something bad. You know, we got to run away from something bad, but a big opportunity that's being presented to them by this situation. And so, in a situation like we're seeing right now evolve in Egypt, the question, a couple of questions, is how many people see this as a wonderful opportunity? It's hard to tell. You know, we watch it on TV and you see some people chanting. You don't know how many people are inside their houses scared to death.
Right. Yeah.
About what this might mean, or how many people are just mad because they think they're really going to lose out. So question one is, how many people are really seeing this as a big opportunity? And then two is are they thinking the same way? I mean, not exactly what needs to be done. That's not the point. But what the opportunity is for the company country at this point. It's large numbers of people really do see this as an opportunity, and they see it in the same kind of general direction. You've got the basis for something good to at least start to happen.
Yeah.
you don't have either of those, then it's already kind of going in what could be a treacherous direction right from the start.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. Sometimes people think of your first step about the urgency as almost that same thing. We're getting mad about something, but I think you've been clear in your writing that this is not necessarily just about getting mad or upset about something. It's something much more sustainable than that, right?
Correct. And what's sustainable is something that we want, something that we can feel emotionally excited about. Just running away from the saber-toothed tiger. It only lasts so long before we get tired and he eats us.
Yeah. Well, you know, that kind of leads me to really the heart of change. As much as I enjoyed leading change, it was the heart of change that influenced me even more. And a statement that I really just never forget. It was along the lines of, the central issue is never strategy, structure, culture, or systems. And that I didn't take it that those aren't important, but it is always about changing the behavior. And so the change really comes when you speak to people's feelings. And I have to say, for most of my management career, I felt like it was people saying things like, Andy, this isn't personal, it's business, or keep the emotions out of it. And yet this clear message from the heart of change is that see, feel, change trumps analysis, think, change in most situations. Would you tell us more about that observation?
Yeah, again, it's another thing we found in one of our kind of big research projects. And it is surprising in the sense that, that's what we teach at the university. If you think about university training in general, and certainly what we do in the business school, it's 90% analytic stuff.
Yeah.
The amount that, you have some little interpersonal course that you have to take and probably nobody much likes to remind people that human beings have emotions and that can influence behavior.
Yeah.
What we learn on the job is not incongruent with what we're taught at the university, but human beings, the more I've gotten interested because of all of this in the increasing amount of people who are paying attention to brain research.
Yeah.
And what they're trying to get out of that. I was always fascinated by Freud, a lot of the details of what he talked about, which I thought were kind of weird, but some basics of this gigantic cave that we're not aware of that's in our head that's got all kinds of stuff in it, and a lot of it certainly isn't my bookshelf. It's feeling stuff. And when we're talking about change, there's got to be some energy behind it, obviously. Mm-hmm. And so then what's the source of the energy? And what you find is people do, we all do. If I can make a perfectly logical argument that it's better for you to have dinner, at home tonight as opposed to at Burger King, and it's a compelling argument, you could just say, darn, I hadn't thought about it that way and do it. But more often than not, what's happening beside that can be more influential, and that's, images that we've got in our head that are attached to emotions about how we're feeling about things that direct our behavior in more powerful ways than, I suppose, in our scientific society that I'm very much a part of, as are you.
Yeah,
we're almost a little bit afraid, emotion,
right?
To admit.
Yeah,
and that's what we found in these change efforts, that a lot of what moved things along was not the data in the analytics in the sense that we teach about it.
Mm-hmm.
It was something that it was experiences that people were in, or experiences that they saw. There's a huge visual component in this that affects how you feel, which then affects then drives behavior. And what clicks for me is that the more I've studied leaders throughout history, is they kind of intuitively understand that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's usually intuitive. I don't think think anybody ever teaches them. They kind of pick it up along the way by watching others and watching what works and what doesn't work. But, you know, symbols and there's one of the great scenes in of the many, 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 many great scenes in movies that is associated with kind of mobilizing a group of people to behave in a way that isn't particularly rational is when George C. Scott played Patton in a movie. And the great memorable scene is right at the beginning where he comes up and gives his little speech to the troops,
right. Standing
in front of this gigantic American flag. And it is not only are his words and just the nonverbals and the way he behaves very powerful, but that image is just astonishingly powerful in an emotional sense. And, of course, this is Hollywood writing the script, but they are getting at something there. I mean, you know, the fact that it doesn't strike us as silly.
Yeah.
That stuff like that, and leaders understand stuff like that, can have a huge impact. And in this case, you know, very, very dramatic, because who can be logically talked into picking up a gun and going out with some reasonable potential of dying?
Yeah.
You can't.
Right.
It has to be an emotional thing. And there's an interesting example of even done partly created by visual images.
I've had the right opportunity to write three books. The first one is almost all facts, probably only two stories in the whole book. And when somebody comes back to me and says something about the book, it's the two stories. That's what they would say. And I don't know if you have a favorite story out of The Heart of Change, but I have to tell you, Jen, one of my favorites is the gloves on the boardroom table one. You know, it's been a while since I've actually read it, but it's just as with the Patton one, not only was it effective in getting the message across, you remember it later on. And there's something about that visual of, well, how do we convince our organization across all these different facilities that we're buying too many different types of gloves for? I mean, the dollar amounts that you had in that story were just staggering, right, of the differences. And yet, for those that haven't read it, just give me a short version of what that story says.
Some middle-level, you know, kind of technical manager on his own is looking at the supply chain and discovers that each of the plants, so everybody's got their own purchasing department, their own vendors, their own negotiated prices, and he starts running around and discovers that that the inefficiencies in this process are incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Some guys are paying, twice as much at one plant than at another for the same item. They're not getting the lowest cost. The whole system, it's just, you know, it's a historical system. It's not using modern technology. It's nuts. And he presented in a report to his boss. And the amounts were, for the size of the company, were very large amounts. I mean, tens of millions of dollars, and added up over years, hundreds of millions. And the boss, you know, reads it and says, you know, this is you make a very good case. And the problem is the top management has, you know, 63 problems right now.
Yeah.
And this just isn't gonna. They don't need 67, you know, 64, and we'll get around to it next year, okay? And he pitches it for some reason. Something happens in a summer intern. A young woman who's in graduate school asks for another project or something, and he pitches this to her, and she goes out and starts looking into it too. She gets tons of data and discovers that it's just as bad as he thought. And then she starts thinking, well, he's already been shot down, so what in the world can I do?
Yeah.
She follows, I don't know how much of it's luck or how much of it's intuition or how much of it is she'd actually been taught by somebody, but she picks an item. She goes to the purchasing people and listens to all the stuff they buy and picks an item that is easy for people to understand and relate to. It requires no explanation about, you know, what is this? Gloves. And they buy tons of gloves of all kinds, welders' gloves, you know, the kind of gloves that guys that just pick up heavy packages and carry them from one type of the plant to the other. And she goes and does some research and comes and discovers that if you add up all the different kinds of gloves at all the different prices for all the different vendors, it's like 425 or something like that kinds of gloves they buy. And some of them, it's the exact same glove for all practical purposes at twice the price. So she goes out and she it takes her a while and she gets a pair of all 425. And she puts a little marker, kind of hangs this little tag on each one of them that says what's the plant, what kind of a glove it is, what's the price, where they got it, and has them drags them into work, goes in to gets permission from somebody's secretary to sneak into the boardroom, and plops and makes this gigantic mountain of gloves right on the boardroom table. So you walk in the room and whoa, And so she goes to her boss and she says, I got an idea. It could be stupid. And if it is, I apologize. And he's saying, what? And she said, well, you've got to see it. And he looks at this thing. Of course, it's kind of, whoa. And he go up. And of course, what you logically do, everybody, is you go up and you kind of stare at it more closely. And then you start looking at these tags. And he looks at her and he says, just for real? And she says, yeah. And this is one of something like 5,000 items we have to buy. Yeah. Do the math.
Yeah.
So he goes to the CEO and does the same little demonstration with the CEO, who, of course, goes, whoa. And the guy, now this is this middle level, 55-year-old kind of engineer, says, you have a executive committee meeting coming up later today, don't you? The CEO says, yeah. And then, of course, the light bulb comes on.
Yeah.
CEO asks him to, first of all, they leave him there. So everybody comes in. Here's all the senior vice presidents. Of course, they go in. Everyone walks in the room. Whoa. And watch this, and everybody does the same thing. They walk over and they stare at it more closely, then they begin to see the tags, and so by the time the CEO shows up, that's all everybody's talking about, of course.
Sure.
And he asks this manager, who brings his summer intern with him too, to give a brief a description about what the heck this is all about.
Yeah.
And he does. It only takes about a 4-minute description. It doesn't take PowerPoint slides in a half an hour. And then the CEO says, this is just one of the things we buy. Yes, sir. Do you have any clue, if you add up all the things we buy, what the inefficiency basically is in the whole internal supply chain? Bring it in. And he says, it's around $52 million a year. And CEO, and of course, everybody around the table is kind of going, oh, God. They're staring at this. They can't, there it is, still in their line of vision. So our engineer says, well, you've got a meeting started. I'll get this stuff out of here. And the CEO says, no, why don't you leave it? Thanks for telling us this. And, of course, what happens is the entire agenda for the meeting is scrapped.
Yeah.
That's all they want to talk about.
Right.
And then be purchasing, and then the whole purchasing system, and then information take. Well, and, of course, you can see where that goes.
Yeah.
And some of them said, I want this same little demo, what we just experienced, I want to happen out in my plant, and manager and the people that report to them, okay? So they took it around the company, and it was called the Glove Show. Seriously.
Yeah.
And what they did with that is they created, enough of a sense of urgency around a big opportunity to save a whole bunch of money. And that's what got it started. And they followed through in an intelligent way, and it made a significant economic difference. And, what's amusing is what started it, which was it's highly analytical,
yeah.
You know, full of exhibits. The numbers were all right.
Yeah.
Report achieved nothing.
Nothing. Yeah, exactly. And yet it was so visual they couldn't ignore it, and so memorable. And there's so many aspects of that that if someone is listening and they haven't read The Heart of Change, I mean, this is one of my favorite ones, but there are so many stories in that book that really just pound in the message from Leading Change that, you know what, it is not just as simple as analysis, think change, that to see, feel change, John, the way that you've communicated that in The Heart of Change, I think is just hugely effective. And, you know, I asked some listeners for questions that they might want to pass by you, and there were a number of them that were related to culture and change. Like in that company, there was the culture of how we've always done things in our procurement and supply chain. And the culture is difficult to change sometimes, right? So the questions were along the lines of, well, we're told we have to embed the change in the culture so they stick, and that sounds good, but it's the culture that keeps us from changing. And so a key message I took from The Heart of Change is that, and the Leading Change, I suppose, as well, but sometimes we try to deal with that culture first instead of last, and I think that's counterintuitive to many people. So, first of all, did I get that right? But also, what do you mean by that?
No, it's completely counterintuitive. It was to me until I began to see some people and figure it out by watching them. I was even involved when the first culture books were produced, which was about the early 1980s.
Yeah.
And they were written, and I actually tried to help some companies with, okay, what you got to do first is change the culture, and then that'll make it more easy to introduce changes like the one we just talked about.
Sure.
And what I discovered first is, A, it didn't work.
Yeah, well, there's that.
I remember, one of the big banks in Chicago.
Yeah.
The culture committee, and I actually sat in on some of their meetings and tried to be helpful. And after about a year, the whole thing just kind of evaporated.
Yeah.
And the reason is, now I see in retrospect, is that isn't the way you do it. What you need to do, the way culture changes is you get a group to act in some new way that isn't the way the culture works, and it actually pays off. They see results that are better than that what they were doing, and those results, and they keep behaving that way, they keep getting the results, and what happens is it's almost as if this new thing starts to just kind of seep automatically into the bloodstream.
Yeah.
You don't have to do anything about it. That's the way culture is. I mean, you know, if you go to a little where they first started, the social anthropologist, some island out in the Pacific. It's not as if they had a culture expert out there, you know.
Yeah, right.
Culture. It just happens naturally, but that's the way it happens.
Yeah.
So the name of the game inside a company then is forget about culture. What we need to do is we need to figure out a process that's powerful enough to get people to do things differently, even if you're getting cultural pushback. Make sure that works, or in other words, they're doing the right things, so they do get a payoff. It's economic economic and other, and then make sure that sticks for a while. It holds on for a while. It just doesn't happen, you know, for 3 months and then disappears back to the old way.
Yeah.
And if that happens, you just make sure that it's kind of institutionalized in the sense that you don't have something that's pushing with the culture against you, like the performance appraisal system or something like that.
Yeah.
And it takes care of itself. The culture, that new way will become the new way we kind of do things around here, and we'll even forget about it. It's just the way we do things.
Yeah.
Which means it's sunk in and it's become a part of the culture. So ironically, culture comes last in this whole thing, not first.
You know, about 6 months ago, I had a local, I'm in the Chicago area, a local chief technology officer called me in and goes, Andy, I want you to help us change our culture here. And about 6 months before that, I had interviewed Ed Schein about his corporate culture survival guide book. And I called Ed back up. I said, Ed, what do you think I ought to do? And he's basically, you can't do it. They have to do it. And along the lines of what you were saying, it's not like you start with this. You know, you have to show that these other changes are going to work, and then it becomes the culture over time. But, you know, once again, for those that haven't read the book, if you haven't read either Leading Change or The Heart of Change, you have to get that to understand it. We don't start with culture first.
Well, make sure to check out the links in the show notes for John's books on change, as well as the website for Cotter International. I've also included a link to John's HBR blog. You know, there's still time for a few more of you to join our Leadership Fast Track program. I'd love to have you join our learning sessions, and it would be a pleasure for me to coach you one-on-one. Check the link in the show notes for details. Well, join me in our next cast when John tells us more about how to avoid letting our ideas get shot down. I'll see you then. Thank you for joining me for this episode of the People and Projects Podcast. Have a great week.
Before I get into this, Dr. Cotter, I was wondering, how would you prefer to be referred to in the interview?
I could care less. Just don't. Hey you, I don't like.
I'll make sure I don't do a hey you, but if it's okay with John, I would be great with that.
That's the way to do it then.